Whose family was killed in that fire and had to escape the burning house and leaped from the second story of the house in order to save their life. And as they fell, another person was standing beneath them on the ground that the falling person hoped would offer safety from the fire that had consumed their home and had destroyed their family. And the falling person, fleeing from the fire, falling through the air, fell on this person and broke their arms and their legs. And the person who had been fallen upon was righteously angry and hurt and was angry with the person who fell upon them. And the person who had fallen on them was defensive and hit the person upon whom they had fallen, who in turn hit them. But both people were simply trying to survive and had been harmed by forces in large part beyond their control. And this enmity continued through the generations. Isaac Deutscher wrote this story, used this metaphor that I have not so well paraphrased, in 1967. And he was speaking, of course, about the relationship of trauma that existed between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. And the house that on fire, of course, represents, from Deutscher's perspective, represented the Holocaust. And the person standing upon the earth represented Palestinians. And harm has occurred to both. The person who was fallen upon and badly injured, and the person who had to leap out of a burning house. And the cycle of enmity that Deutscher describes really makes sense in terms of how humans function in many cases when they experience trauma. So that's a rather heavy story to start a conversation that we hope that hopefully will be a real conversation, a discussion. The idea for this, my name is Reiner Waldman Atkins. My buddy here, Rabbi Johanna Kinberg, actually, you presented the idea for this, really, because you mentioned that when you have been in circumstances, including Camp Holden, that you were buttonholed a lot and asked to, why don't you use your own words?
Oh, I think it was just interesting for me when I'm sometimes in progressive Christian environments about assumptions that are made about my perspective about Israel-Palestine, given my presence within the community. And I was just surprised. I thought, oh, this is an opportunity for conversation and to go deeper, because it's clearly a conversation within progressive Christian environments to talk about Israel and Palestine, and then in the Jewish community, we talk about it, but when do we talk about it together? Not very often. And I could tell that we weren't well practiced, and I thought this is an opportunity for us to have conversations together about this, in part because we come from very progressive Jewish background. And so we're sort of we have a very similar worldview concerns, big picture. Big picture, we're often praying for the same things. I feel very comfortable in Holy Spirit, which is my local Kirkland Lutheran church. I spoke during one of their Lent services, and the whole culture, everything feels very similar and comfortable. But once we start talking about Israel-Palestine, I'm like, oh, these are the things we don't talk about. So we'll talk tonight. And I think this is just such a great opportunity to have interaction and really to get more nuance.
Something that's important to acknowledge is Johanna and I are Jewish, and my wife Deb, who many of you have met, and there are some other, couple of other people I've encountered here who have a Jewish background, but there are no Palestinians here, and that's important to acknowledge. Both Johanna and I have our own relationship, our own activism with this issue. I've been involved in working with Mideast peace issues. Well, Mideast peace is kind of a nebbishy way to say it. I've been involved in working on peace in Israel and Palestine and just peace for some time as a Jewish activist. That culminated for me 2 years ago when I went with a large group of people from the Center for Jewish Nonviolence on a trip to Israel and Palestine inspired by Freedom Summer. And worked in partnership with Israelis and Palestinians under the leadership of nonviolent Palestinian activists. During Freedom Summer, white folks from the north went south, and they didn't just dip in. They put their bodies on the line under the leadership of black southern civil rights activists engaged in struggle, and that was significantly different than dipping in and out. People, there's ways that many of us can use our privilege and our relative safety in the world to put our bodies on the ground in a place rather than simply dipping in and out. And we were Jews who came from all sorts of different backgrounds. People who were staunch Zionists, people who were staunch anti-Zionists, and people with all sorts of permutations within that spectrum. And the issue there was fundamental solidarity with people who, in affirmation of their other basic human rights. And it was a very transformative experience, and it was very difficult. And coming back, I think for many of us, as we shared our experience in the community, one of the things that came up was how the people we were sharing it with, including people who were non-Jewish, people who were Christian, was how can these people be allies with us in the work that we're doing as allies for the brave Israelis and Palestinians who are working for peace and justice. And there's not very many conversations where we can really delve into that. There's a lot of polarization, and there's a lot of anger that gets expressed, and a lot of parallels. The question is, how can we build a fundament of very basic empathy, even with people we might disagree with, that can help us be more effective allies for, as you folks so eloquently were putting out, for the children, for the future, for a future of opportunity for Palestinian children and Israeli children? How can we make a better world? And in some ways, it's kind of hard to be eloquent and precise about this. So there's the issue of empathy. There's also direct political action people can take as Americans. That kind of reflects what we were saying before about how Freedom Summer was an inspiration for the work that Palestinian nonviolent activists, Israeli nonviolent activists, and foreign Jewish nonviolent activists have been doing the last couple of years in the West Bank to build some kind of hope, and in the name of what in Arabic is called samud, which means steadfastness. And I talked to a lot of my Israeli friends, and samud's parallel is hatmada in Hebrew.
Progress.
Those are some of the basic questions. How can we understand how historical trauma has affected people in very, very different ways? We're not trying to make equivalents about the experiences. every trauma has both a universal and a unique character. There's the issue of trauma for people who are in an oppressed situation and the trauma that causes the oppressor to function in certain ways. And how can we actually take action that's supportive? And how the kind of spirit that's being expressed here in Holden Village so eloquently plays into this right here at home.
Rainer, my understanding of Freedom Summer was that there were freedom rides in the South and whites from the North came down and rode the buses and pretty much were combating the Jim Crow South, the segregationist South. So by using that analogy, are you saying that Israel is segregated, Palestinians can go one place and Israelis can go another, and you were doing something, were you riding buses there, or what were you doing?
No, what we were doing there was was basically putting our bodies on there on the ground, rather literally, okay. Returning Palestinians to help, working with Palestinians to return them to their homes,
okay.
From which they had been displaced.
Okay.
And so the analogy with Freedom Summer was that was what it meant to be allies and demonstrate solidarity, not by dipping in and out, because that happens quite a bit, but what it meant to actually be in coalition to build something there over a period of time. And that particular experience created what was called Camp Samud in a community called Sarura, which is in the South Hebron Hills. While we were there, it was destroyed once, and it's been destroyed about three or four other times, but every time it's been rebuilt, and it's still there. These families are still in that particular area, and it's been rebuilt by Israelis and Palestinians and people and Jews from abroad. So it's a really unique coalition that's existed, and there's been a really fascinating feeding back and forth about what it meant for all these different nonviolent activists to come together and how that strengthened specifically Palestinians who were engaged in nonviolent struggle for fundamental rights.
Are the Palestinians both Christian and Muslim?
The Palestinians are both Christian and Muslim. One of the organizations we were working with was Holy Land Trust, which is more from a Christian perspective, but not entirely. But the Palestinians that we were working with, most specifically, were Muslim. But in any case, we thought it would be, with this assumption that kind of the goal of this evening is to kind of understand how empathy is the first step, and that empathy is a complicated thing. We can open up the conversation for about how people can engage with this. And Johanna and I and anybody else, I mean, we're just two people.
Yeah.
And any others of you who have been involved in this work, you know, this is not, we're not going to give some perfect solution, right? But I think it's important to learn how to speak so people can hear you. And that comes from some sense of empathy frequently. So anyway, I realize I'm sounding kind of heavy, and let's have a spirited conversation.
Two real quick things. One is a story. We lived in Asia, in Hong Kong years ago, and we were down in Indonesia, one of the islands, one of the hundreds of islands. When we came back, there was, as typically, sad to say, happened, war between, in this case, Christians and Muslims. And the South China Morning Post reported on this, that young people, these were not, so it's like the children we're talking about, the young people were doing the killing, and they were taking the heads and putting them on stakes in their village. And the reporter, which amazed me that a reporter actually went down and said, so why are you doing this? And these young kids were saying, I don't know. Grandpa told us that we hate those people, so we're supposed to do this. So that generational, and I often wonder when I see the rocks being pitched in the West Bank and in Israel, do they know why they're doing what they're doing? Do I hate because I've been taught to hate? And when you talked about historical drama, how that historical drama, whether you've lived it or not, you hear the story, the next generation hears the story, hears the story. So then I kind of wonder, who do you start talking with? The grandpas or the kids? And then just one other quick one. I had the opportunity to be in Israel and Jordan in March. And I was absolutely amazed that our bus driver was Jewish, our guide was Jewish, but when we went to Bethlehem, the guide had to leave and another guide had to come in as we went to Bethlehem and go, hey, this is, I didn't understand it. And I think that there's also the ignorance, I'll use that word, ignorance for me in America about really what's going on. Because we've also been taught by grandpas.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are all these different stories. So then it gets to your empathy words of how difficult it is to have empathy when I really first have to recognize I'm damn ignorant about what's going on.
Uh-huh.
Generationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
I work in the Middle East for the Quakers in the 80s with my husband Ron Young for the American Friends of Risk Committee and the American and the British and Canadian Quakers. And we got sent over there for 3 years. We had never even been there. but they sort of trusted us and we worked with the Quakers. And our job was to listen. And I mean, the stories, I mean, how you started out, I really appreciated that because we thought, well, we know so little. Our job is really to go around and just to hear as many stories as we can. And so we really tried to, you know, in the good Quaker spirit, get around to, even to settlements, to kibbutz up in, you know, Kiryat Shmona in the north where people had experienced rocket attacks, to Palestinian villages, to, and I think listening to the stories of people without, I mean, this doesn't get to, you know, the policy questions, which are fraught and really hard, especially now. But to start with the listening and the stories without having to, like, to choose one over another, which is our natural tendency a lot of times. Well, which story is right? Well, you know, and the story that I always loved to tell was the story of, you know, that, I mean, maybe it's a story from, I don't know, Hindu tradition, but the story of the blind person and the elephant, you know, the story?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, like, you're, you know, blind person is touching the elephant, you know, leg, oh, it's a tree, you know, different parts of the, that there were many truths. And in fact, the experience there for me, because I was coming out of a pretty righteous anger about U.S. policy and anti-imperialism and all this, and that there was truth, and then there was, you know, like, not truth. And this, like, really, really, like, you know, changed my whole my whole way of understanding truth, because, in fact, there are multiple truths and multiple stories. And so that, I think, how we, it's hard to do that. But that listening is so important before we go on to the policy questions. So we had the privilege, I mean, in a way of, like, then you can hear, when you get to action stuff, you can hear the voices of people. I mean, you can hear, like, well, what would they say, you know? What would this be to them? Because you've really listened and heard their story. And it doesn't make the policy stuff easy, but I think it's really important. Thank you for...
Thank you.
What I was thinking about, what were you saying, this idea of
do the people in Palestine hate, have this hate? And it's like I was there last year and, you know, went to Bethlehem and the West Bank and so on, and all I saw were people that wanted to sell me stuff. And you know, we're caught in this web of story that has been fed to us, and all I heard was frustration. Like I know why you got a different driver when you went into Bethlehem, because Israelis are told, don't go to Bethlehem, it's dangerous. They'll probably kill you when you go in. I'm on a bus that goes in. I don't know who they think I am, other than someone that has some money to spend. And I think if the Israelis came in, they'd be happy to sell them trinkets and come to my restaurant and so on. But the frustrations of the people of Palestine that we don't recognize, it's an occupied territory. Our driver, who is a Palestinian Christian, he lives in Bethlehem, so he's not a citizen of Israel. But Palestine is not a state, so the Israelis don't allow him to have a passport for him to travel. He can't fly out of the international airport in Tel Aviv. If he has business, say, in America, say, he has to get permission from the Israeli government to leave Israel to go to Jordan, because he can fly out of Amman. He can't fly out of Israel because he's not Israeli, he's not Palestinian, he's nothing. They have, for the Palestinians, they're not even allowed to drill a well in the West Bank. The Israelis control everything. And I couldn't understand what was going on there. We met with a lot of Christian Palestinian groups, peace groups, I think the Holy Land Trust too, and they just want the Palestinians to leave, is what I came to the conclusion that I found. And we don't hear that.
There's also a struggle going on in Israeli society that perhaps we as Americans can identify with, because in certain ways, only in certain ways, we're having the same struggle here about what the destiny of America is, and what groups of people see themselves gaining or losing through the maintenance of power. And I think one thing, people working for a just outcome in Israel are having a really hard time right now, but they do exist. And even though it's a real struggle because of the growth of right-wing nationalism, the power of right-wing nationalism, and the intersection of right-wing nationalism and a certain kind of religious perspective, there still are a significant number of people working for the good. So when we say they, that's something to watch out for. Can we make a distinguish between policy and people? People, of course, make policy. There's many, many ways that in our lives we talk about them. Certainly I, as a Jew, when I think about coming to a Lutheran camp, there's a little bit of they thinking in my mind that I have to transcend.
Yeah.
And any of you would, I'm sure, have your theys, and we have to. But how do we get past that? How do we? It's very logical for us to think that way. But how do we get past it? How do we find the people who are really working for the good, the people who transcend, the people for, you know, where there's a little crack in the armor that certain ideas can get through?
I think we're also dealing, as Lutherans who tend to be largely Scandinavian and German, are having a hard time dealing with us and understanding our role. And a number of us are reading a book called Dear Church, and my own church is doing it. We're starting it here, because there's a group in my church here now. And there are others that are picking up this book that are wanting to talk about it, and it's about an African-American man who comes from a very, very unusual background into this white church and is accepted and ordained, even though his history looks like it's something someone you didn't even want to walk in the front door. And so, also having been in Israel and in Palestine, going from more perhaps from some leader who wanted to expose us to a leader from here in the United States, wanted to expose us to some of his experiences in working in Palestine, but to show us both sides of the story as well as he could. And it was very difficult for him to be able to get Jewish participation. We were actually talked at for about 45 minutes in a settlement, and it was so starkly different than anything that I expected to experience. While when we were at Tent of Nations, which is the last hill, and I mean, they struggled. He was going back to do a sabbatical this year, and he got to the border and was denied entrance into Israel and needed to do some other things in Jordan. But we saw lots of people. We saw people who were accompanying Palestinians as they tried to get from here to there, and some of the stories that were troubling, I guess, to say the least, as to how people needed to live. And yet, having grown up in a Jewish neighborhood and raising my children in a Jewish neighborhood, I had a very different feeling as to who those people are now as grown-ups, talking to them. And I have very dear friends who said, well, we don't believe that. Jewish friends, we don't believe that. And there's so many conflicts. And what I said, well, what would you like us to do? Just tell what you see. And tell your story as you see it. And I hear both sides of the story.
Yeah, having the chance to hear the stories is really critical. If you, since several of you have already said that you've been to that part of the world, there are organizations that can expose you to the stories. First of all, in terms of being a tourist, there's a tour company called Mejdi Tours. That was founded by a fellow named Aziz Abusara, who some of us in Seattle and the organization J Street were involved in bringing and having him speak at Hillel in Seattle. He's Palestinian, and this is specifically a tour company that is designed actually in many parts of the world, but especially in Israel and Palestine, to expose people stories to the different narratives, to the different voices. In Jerusalem, there's an organization called Ir Shalem, which gives people tours of what's going on in Jerusalem in terms of people working for justice, but also the divisions that are happening in Jerusalem. And there's a group of past soldiers called Breaking the Silence. And these are soldiers who have served in the West Bank and are telling their stories and are extremely controversial because, among other things, they have the credentials to speak up because they were in the IDF, in the occupation of the West Bank. They participated in that. And finally, there's an organization. Well, I mean, there's lots of other groups, but there are two organizations to know about. One is called Combatants for Peace. And I believe still on Netflix, there's a movie that's been made, a film that's been made about them called Disturbing the Peace.
Mm-hmm. I actually have a copy of that.
Have you seen it?
We could show it.
And it's really worth seeing. Yeah. It's a wonderful organization. It's Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs who have in some way or another been involved in being combatants in some way or another, as soldiers, as rock throwers, as guerrillas, all sorts of different ways. And they're pretty incredible people.
Is the parent circle still? I mean,
there's the parent circle or the bereaved families forum.
Yeah.
And these are people who have lost relatives, who have lost dear ones to violence.
On both sides. Yeah.
And what they do talking about hearing the voice of the other and having empathy is in Israel, there's Yom HaZikaron. It's the Memorial Day concept. And in an Israeli context, it's about all the people who have lost their lives defending Israel. And but there is another Memorial Day experience that happens of Israelis and Palestinians coming together, thousands of them, through organizations like the Marie Families Forum, to have a collective Yom HaZikaron Memorial Day for everybody in both communities who we've lost. So there, you know, these are examples of the resources that are available and the work that people are doing. And there are even settlers doing work. There is a person who grew up in a family in Seattle. His name is Shaul Jodelman. Grew up in Beth Shalom. Mm-hmm. And they form an organization called Roots. He's working with a Palestinian, I think, named Ali Abu Awad. Aziz Abu Awad, I think. And Shaul lives in a settlement, and he has brought in other Jewish settlers who are working with Palestinians in that context to build connection. So there's so much there's a lot going on, and it's really difficult, but that can give some sense of who the people are who will be the bridges to any solution.
One of the things I encountered last year, which I thought was interesting, is that in my conversations about Israel-Palestine, a few people made assumptions that I was a supporter of the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement, which I'm not. That led to interesting conversation as to, from my perspective, is why would you assume that I would support that? And from their perspective, like, why wouldn't you support that? And so, I do consider myself a Zionist, and it's a label I wear proudly. And for me, when someone says that they're anti-Zionist, it's the same as someone saying I'm anti-American. And I say this because my mother immigrated to Israel as a refugee from Morocco in the 1960s. When Morocco joined the Arab League, there was persecution of Jews within Arab-majority and Muslim-majority countries, and so she left illegally along with the rest of her family through France and went to Israel as refugees. And so the only reason I'm here is because my mother had a place of safe harbor to go to and a place to of refuge. And so my family's experience, my family just, locked the door and left all their possessions, as did hundreds of thousands of Jews from Muslim countries who left all of their businesses, their possessions, everything they had to go to a place of refuge. And so when we have the conversation about Israel and Palestine, I mean, I'm coming from the perspective of someone whose family was refugees to go there. So from my perspective, it's refugees and refugees having a conversation about where can we possibly live on this planet that's safe. And as someone whose mother was a refugee to Israel and then ended up living most of my life in the Pacific Northwest, my worldview is one of, oh, but I live on the land of these other people. Like, the only reason I'm safe here is because we took land from Native people, and now I live on their land. And so, I follow Northwest Treaty Tribes on Facebook. And Northwest Treaty Tribes lets me know every single week in what ways our government's in violation of the treaties with Native tribes that we made treaties with, especially around, but this is specifically mostly in Washington State. Mm-hmm. So these are, I live right by the Nisqually, so this is right where I live, actually. And to just be very present in the reality of, if I choose to live here, I'm living on someone else's land. If I choose to live in Israel, and I'm also Israeli and a citizen of Israel, I am also displacing someone. Basically, I can't live anywhere on this planet right now without displacing someone. What do we do about that? I mean, that's, and I'm not the only person. I mean, we think about all the undocumented people in this country, and then all the people who have an unknown or marginal status living in the territories, living in the West Bank or in Gaza. There are lots of people on this planet that just don't belong anywhere anymore. And that's a real problem. But I think when when we talk about the empathy, it's the empathy of when we're too dogmatic about certain issues, we create a situation where some people just have no place to live. And we don't want that. We don't want there to be a place for no one to live. So how do we have people living together peacefully? And for me, part of that is about teaching peace, kind of ignoring the adults and going right for the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, that maybe this generation needs to die out in the desert because there's going to be new leadership, because our rituals and our processes just lead to children's sacrifice over and over again. I mean, that's just what happens, is we just end up sacrificing our children. Just an interesting turn of events in my life, we moved to Olympia, Washington in 2003, the summer that Rachel Corrie was killed, protesting the Israeli government. And so we move into this community where Rachel lived and grew up, and we ended up sending our children to the elementary school where she grew up and where she lived. And so we've been in relationship with her parents, the Corries, since she died. And you know what? And it's just so interesting to see about how, you know, this child was brought into this whole situation. And our co-op in Olympia did boycott Israel and is part of the BDS movement. And we lived through that in our community. And it was really uncomfortable. And it was really horrible. It didn't feel like it was doing anything to help Palestinians. And it made life in our community pretty icky. And so I've just been really interested in how to work with populations, especially in the Northwest, who care about Israel-Palestine. How can we do it in a way where we don't eat each other alive? Because that's what happened in Olympia, is it's a lot of people who care about a lot of people and who are very loving, ending up with a lot of negativity and discord. And so it's that there. So we have to move beyond that of wanting. And of course, I mean, look, I think that what Israel's government is doing right now is horrific. I'm horrified about the relationship with Trump. And that's when you leave this place and have to re-engage with the rest of the world, you're going to learn that Israel and Trump and racism and is all very hot in the news right now. And it's a horrible situation. And to not be tempted to forget that Israel is a democracy just like we are, and they have a representational government. It's based on the British Parliament, so they're in coalition. And so when they form coalitions, it can be a very, very broad group of people who agree on a couple of issues. But Israelis are just as responsible individually for what happens on the West Bank as we are individually responsible for what our government is doing to the children in detention, right? Mm-hmm. That our government represents us living in a democracy just as much, and each of us individually, just as much as Israel's government represents every individual Israeli, if we have this representative democracy. So what does it mean to take on that mantle of responsibility? We know that in Israel there are Israelis who do it, who say, you know, the government's doing this in my name, not in my name. And there's Americans who believe that too, not in my name. But we all have to be responsible for what our governments do to people, and understand that we have to benefit in some way from the status quo, right? Mm-hmm. And just as Israelis benefit in some way from the status quo. And the disruption of that status quo requires a lot of trust. And I think that's where sometimes when Israelis don't trust that if we disrupt the status quo that they're going to be okay. I don't think that they trust that the world community is going to make sure that they're okay if that status quo and the militarism is disrupted. And so just like many Americans are very, very afraid of the status quo being disrupted and what that will mean. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's just sort of some underpinnings of when we're talking about empathy, is like, how can we really, you know, get into the emotions of the situation? How do Native people, how do the Squally feel in our situation? How do we feel as people who are the colonizers?
One of the things that we talk about in the Twin Cities through an interfaith group is the lie that there isn't enough. And I think that's mm-hmm. I think that's really a big, big part of it, is that you operate from a model of scarcity and everybody's trying to grab what they can have, what they think they need because they're afraid they won't get it in some other way.
Yeah, in a sense, the idea that somehow if you have what you need, that takes away from me mm-hmm. or somebody else seems parallel to the idea that in any struggle that someone's going to have to surrender their identity. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the case, you know, in my political work, I've encountered a lot of people saying that Palestinians have no right to exist, really. Palestinians are kind of like fake news. And I've had people tell me that I don't have, you know, my identity, your identity doesn't count. That, you know, there's one particular organization that brings good Palestinians to town. I think you know which one I'm talking about. In other words, Palestinians who are Zionist. And it kind of boggles my mind, but and then in some of my political work on the left, you know, there are good Jews and bad Jews. Kosher Jews, in the sense of being appropriate Jews, are Jews who have rejected a relationship with Israel. That's not functional. So how can we, and psychologists tell us that people will change, are much more likely to change, if in some way that change affirms their sense of identity. And that's where good allies really come into play. You know, the top, you mentioned BDS, and one of the things that happens is there are fervently pro-BDS people and fervently anti-BDS people, but what about the nuance in between? Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm an artist and I don't believe in artistic and academic boycotts. I believe artists, cultural workers, need to go and be able to show support and give power to the people who are really trying to make decent decisions. And on the other hand, I boycott settlement products. But that's kind of complicated, having those two perspectives.
I was involved one time several years ago with the conflict in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And our program there was called Memory, Identity, and Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. It's a hard sell, and it's still struggling. But part of the crux of it was, of course, the identity based on memory. And how do you change that? That's just the grassroots part. But there are the people that want to help the process work, and those who don't. And what is our responsibility as Americans for agitations that we don't even know about, for forces that we can't understand, whether it's within Israel or within our country that has something to gain by the problems that exist there.
So I was just thinking about the idea of trauma and the creation of Israel as a reaction to the trauma of the Jewish people throughout history, especially after World War II. But it's hard, or we don't recognize the trauma of the Palestinian people through that creation of that state taking their land. And in a sense, it made me think about here in America, how we don't recognize the trauma to African-American people through their enslavement, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow, and all that, that we just won't deal with it because it might reflect badly on us. We can't deal with it. It's sort of the same blank wall, we can't talk about it, we don't want to think about it, because it might lead to reparations, or it might cost me out of my pocket, or I might have to feel bad. It's sort of, it looks similar to me.
And their sense of competition between traumas.
Yeah, my trauma is worse than yours. Yeah.
That's terrible to say. Oh, gosh. Competition of traumas. And traumas.
It is terrible.
Yeah.
But it's a reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it seems to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I told the story, the thing of Deutscher's analogy at the beginning, because Israel came out of the disaster of the Holocaust. And Palestinians, in certain ways, were the next victims of the Holocaust. But you can't, you know, the true traumas are interlinked. I went traveling in Europe in the fall, and for some time, and I was in a situation, where we were staying in homes, and we were given a very generous homestay in Paris by a person who was very progressive, and she was doing a lot of good work, but it became quite uncomfortable. A, she really, really hated the idea of Muslim women of Muslim women following hijab, and she was quite Islamophobic and very progressive, and it was very confusing, and you know, I work with people wearing hijab, and I have little girls who wear hijab who I'm involved with as an educator. And I, you know, in a funny sort of way, I ended up being kind of this missionary for the American way. And in France, they're having their own particular struggle. And then she started on, well, you're Jewish. And she knew I'd been involved in Israeli-Palestinian peace and justice work. How could Jews possibly do this? How could you go through what you had gone through and then go off and oppress another people? And I tried to say things about how human psychology works and how people have different responses to trauma. And she said, her favorite phrase was, "May no, 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 no." and finally, I just had enough. I kind of lost it. I said, you know, Europeans have a lot to apologize for. And because, you know, and she said, but my father was in the resistance.
Well, great.
That doesn't negate the fact that Europeans have a lot to apologize for accountability. And, you know, there was this cycle of events. And then the fact that even still here in the United States, the safest place in many ways that Jews have lived, I don't leave Jewish symbols in my car. I don't know what you do.
Oh yeah, I mean I don't wear a yarmulke in public. We don't. I mean it's not safe. It's not a.
In America.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
We're talking about Germany.
No.
Yeah. But, I mean, wasn't that just said in Germany, where the public leaders said if you're Jewish, don't wear your yarmulke?
Yeah.
Yeah, there were people who said that.
I mean that's now.
So.
Yeah, we're not talking.
So all these things are interlinked,
yeah.
And then I was asked by a rabbi friend, the rabbi who performed my marriage a long time ago, if I would do him a favor and host two tour guides who had worked with Mejdi Tours. And I was asked not to use social media to promote it. Why? Because that Palestinian, there was a good chance they wouldn't be allowed into the United States. This is a Palestinian who has received incredible kudos for doing tours that really demonstrate that give voice to all the narratives. And people are just raving about his ability to cross bridges and get people thinking. And but yes, if Hanan Ashrawi, a prominent Palestinian negotiator and political elite figure, is not allowed into the United States, what about some poor guy who's the tour guide? So this is the reality, you know. All these things are intermeshing. And
why wasn't he allowed in the United States?
Well, he was afraid he wouldn't be allowed in the United States because...
I don't mean the tour guide, I mean the other...
She's a woman.
Because she's a Palestinian woman political figure who is a Palestinian nationalist.
God only knows what you do if she got here.
Who was one of the leading negotiators in the whole Oslo process and is one of the best known Palestinian political figures.
From? Where did she live?
Ramallah. Palestine.
She lives in Ramallah. And she was not allowed a visa to enter the United States.
Was this because of the Muslim ban?
No, she's a Palestinian political activist.
She was singled out.
She was singled out.
When was this?
Recently.
A couple months ago.
Oh, yeah, I missed that.
So Palestinians and Muslims and Jews all have the various ways that they don't feel safe. Mm-hmm. And then this plays into dynamics that slow down, that impede the work that needs to happen. So in our community, which is very divided, the question about how do we convince people that it contributes to their safety and their well-being and the future of the Jewish people to take a different approach is a very fraught question. And part of it and it really is about safety. So how do we convince them that other people have their back if they take a breath and shift somewhat? And how do Palestinians know that somebody's got their back in a productive way? That's a kind of open question that I think underlies a lot of what we're talking about.
Did you feel safer 10 years ago? Maybe would you worn yarmulke or left symbols in your car that you were Jewish? 10 years ago? 15 years ago?
I mean, since I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, you know, our synagogue was shot up by neo-Nazis in Eugene when I was a kid. And then it's just, you know... I mean, you know, white nationalists have been very active in the Pacific Northwest for a long time.
Okay.
So my life has always had that, you know, there's neo-Nazis around. Yeah, and there's, you know, and also living close to so many tribes, also realizing, you know, what this country is, you know, capable of and how we live. Yes, absolutely. You know, I was thinking about... Theodor Herzl is the founder of modern Zionism, and he, before he came up with the Zionist idea of having what his initial idea was, a land of refuge for Jews. It was basically, give us just a place on the planet where we can go to be safe. But before that, he actually started to promote Jews just converting all their children to Christianity because he said, we're never, ever going to be accepted or safe here. And, you know, and this is in the 1800s. This was the founding of modern Zionism. So Zionism, the idea of modern Zionism, you know, Jews could have been going to Palestine at any time and just plopping down there throughout most of world history, and they didn't choose to, right? They chose to stay wherever they were living. But it was one of those push factors of, actually, this is an impossible situation. And this was long before the Holocaust. So this was, had they not been thinking, they had already sort of realized, European Jewry, that this could possibly be a long-term no-go for their whole population. And it turns out they were right. It was a long-term no-go. The Jewish population of Europe was decimated. And so this idea of a place of refuge where people can just go to be safe, it's just so interesting that it even exists on our planet. That there's actually like one group of people, and we know that there's actually lots of groups of people who just want a place to be safe. And so we were saying before about when we have these conflicts between Israel and Palestine, you know, that it's generational history. But my experience is that for Israelis, which is a lot of my family, who honestly, I don't have a lot of relationships with, because it's really hard to bridge our world views. They live in a constant state of fear and terror. They just do. That's just how they live. And it's really, and I mean, when I live there, I do too. You know, that's just, it's hard to understand because we don't live there, but they also feel terrorized all the time. And so they're constantly in this defensive state of feeling like we're defending ourselves. Mm-hmm. So while we might perceive it as being over militaristic and being, what's the opposite of defense? It's
offense.
Yeah. Offense. And from their perspective, they see it as defense. Now, I think you can make many, many righteous and rational arguments that this is not defense anymore, that this is not, and it doesn't, and it's not leading to any greater safety for Israelis. They're still living in fear all the time, so it's not like we're making any movement. Everybody's living in fear, so it's a lose-lose. You know, it's a lose-lose situation, and the question is, how do you get from lose-lose to win-win?
If you think of in this country, I mean, jumping for a minute, of the threats to, you know, to Muslim communities, to Jewish communities, and the solidarity actions that have happened, one of the things I'm wondering, I mean, in this state, you know, Faith Action Network that I'm part of, you know, when Christchurch happens or when Tree of Life happens, and I'm sure this is true in many of our communities, like you have, you know, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs, you know, all coming together to like have a vigil, to do this or that. And it relates, I mean, what's interesting to me, to the degree we're talking about safety issue and the trauma, And you know, and I know, like, well, when we did, you know, I organized a vigil in Everett after Tree of Life, and the synagogue was only 3 blocks from where we were going to have the initial rally, but they didn't want us to walk to the synagogue in Everett. They were afraid. And
you mean the community was afraid?
And it was a new rabbi, and they were trying to discern. Do we really want people knowing where we are?
Yeah.
But having those actions, and we can all be together on those actions. But then, when we get to the question of Israel-Palestine, it gets really, you know, divided, or we don't try not to talk about it, which is what we do in Faith Action Network. But from what you're sharing tonight, one of the things that I need to think more about is if we, we're coming together in those kind of things here because of people feeling they're targeted, they're attacked, they're unsafe. Is there a way to take some of that thinking and sharing and collaboration into this really fraught issue, because it's
Well, there's productive contradictions that exist. There's a poll that was done recently of Americans about anti-Muslim bigotry, and it was really fascinating because by far the group that had the least amount of Islamophobic attitudes were Jews.
Jews, of course.
Dramatically,
yes.
Fewer.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Jews were the group right above Muslims. Muslims are Islam. There are Islamophobic Muslims, in a sense, you know. But, you know, if you look at the history of any group that has been in a tenuous situation, these kinds of things do happen. But in any case, so Jews were most likely to have relationships with Muslims, mm-hmm. to have empathy with Muslim religious freedom, to be most willing to ask a Muslim friend for help if they needed it, to feel safe about doing that. However, the stereotype that exists is that Jews and Muslims are engaged in a lot of conflict. The stereotype that exists that we hear a lot. But exactly what you're describing was rather the opposite.
It is in Snohomish County, where, I mean, you know, it's the rabbi and the among, I mean, they gravitate to each other, and they, yeah. and they you know, and this is sort of new stuff too, because they're both new, but it totally bears out what you're saying. And they also, you know, I mean, if you look at the percentage of rabbis that came after the maps, Adam Jamal's synagogue was, you know, after the mosque was vandalized, you know, and they had, you know, original, it was like probably 80% of rabbis that were, you know, mm-hmm. were in the, you know, King County were there. But maybe like 1% of Christian clergy. You know, I mean, because there's a lot more Christian clergy than there are rabbis.
That's true.
But you have to say that. But the truth was that you looked around and, like, you know, every rabbi you knew practically was at that, you know. So it's completely in line with that poll.
And when the information, when I shared information with this poll in this particular context with other Jewish activists, they were surprised. So all these contradictions at work, but information like this provides content that makes a bridge to dealing with other issues.
That's the hope.
And I know it's comfort. I mean, I think I was just meeting recently with an Israeli group because, you know, there's been a lot of immigration from Israel to the United States. So there's a lot more Israelis living in the United States, and since they have their own identity separate from Jews. American Jews have been, you know, are different from Israelis, even though we share the same religion. And one of the things they were sharing is that that in America they feel as though they're sort of not seen in terms of being, you know, people who have their own experience too. I think that when what's helpful is for there to be a sense of the world community saying we want to see everyone succeed. We want to see everyone thrive, and that it doesn't have to be a winner and a loser. And because the world has been so much based on that, I think it's hard for Israelis to see that they're not going to end up being the loser here, and that the stability that they've created in their lives, almost all of them one generation away from having been refugees, was, well, what are we supposed to, you know, what are we supposed to do? So I think there's that, you know, more of a voice of, we want to see everyone thrive in that area of the world. I have, you know, this sort of a theological idea about it, because it seems not to be an accident of history that everything's happening in this one place. You know, that there's so much tension and animosity, and it's, you know, Christian, Jews, and Muslims all in the same place, fighting over the same thing. It seems like there's a message there to us about what we're supposed to do, which is to not fight over it, right? That we're not supposed to, that just like with the Binding of Isaac story, that bloodshed is not what's desired here. This is not an altar to keep sacrificing our children on. This is not what's wanted. And when, you know, that, I mean, my dream is that Jerusalem will be an international city of peace, and it'll belong to the whole world. Now, getting Israel to give up Jerusalem is a huge sacrifice, truly. It would be like a sacrifice. They would be like, we're cutting off a limb. But I think it's worth it. I think that sometimes there are sacrifices that are worth it. And that this is this, and Jerusalem is actually worth sacrificing. If you can imagine an international city of peace on our planet that is like a special, special place where people from all over the world come and discuss ideas, and yeah. I mean, it could be incredible.
Absolutely.
And I was saying to Terry, but the reality is that a lot of the time Jerusalem functions in that way, and that people do, especially in the old city, just move around. It's happening. It's actually happening right now. They might be sleeping, but they're all sleeping in that same walled city. And so it's actually happening. The question is, how do we make it happen consciously and with purpose as a solution long-term to our problems as a planet, not just as, you know, with specific areas? Because we know that, you know, America, we have this, you know, very similar problems to Israel in terms of our ideas around land and controlling people and their identities. And so I think there's an opportunity here. You know, that Israel and Palestine is really an opportunity for the world to invest in peace, but it's about how do we love them in the right way. You know, how do we love Palestinians in a way that makes them feel uplifted, and how do we love Israelis in a way that makes them feel safe? And I think we all will just have to work a little harder to get that right.
The Arabic for Jerusalem, I was just thinking of the song, you know, it's, you know, Jerusalem is in English, you know, Yerushalayim is Hebrew, right? Is that, and then Al-Quds is Arabic. So just
want
to put that out on the table.
We have never even covered the role of the right-wing American evangelist.
Oh my
gosh. Yeah,
no,
I know.
Well, it's undermining everything.
And that's something that's very, very important in this context here.
Yeah.
By the way, Al-Quds means the holy.
Yeah.
And Quds, and the Arabic Quds and the Hebrew Kodesh come from the same root. And a couple of things. One is that it's really significantly important for people who are active Christians to counter Christian Zionism.
Yes.
Christian Zionism is inherently
destructive,
and it's certainly anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim. It's really also anti-Semitic.
It's anti Christian Zionists to talk to us when we were over there. People from a settlement did, but the Christian Zionists wouldn't talk to us at all.
Interesting.
What do you think?
Because what we were going to say would be threatened, with the questions we were asking, would be threatening. And that was basically the problem with the Jewish man.
So imagine...
You mean Christian Zionism. I want to say this, though, that Christian Zionism is a specific, you know, ideology and so forth. That when we say Christian, I mean, it's, you know, I feel like I am a Christian, and I am also a Zionist, okay? I mean, because I believe okay. in Israel's rights exist. I'm not a Christian Zionist in quotes, but
so wants it all destroyed.
I need to say that because I know too many people that think.
Thank you for that correction.
Yeah. Maybe it's evangelical Christian.
Evangelical Christian Zionist says that unless we get over there and let all the Jews get back to Israel and then convert all of them to Christianity. Right. The end of the world can't come.
Yeah. It's pre-millennial
dispensation. So that's a specific ideology that has a very powerful movement here.
It does.
And I appreciate what you were saying about your own relationship to Israel. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very significant for Christians to say, I can support peace and justice in Israel and Palestine, and I have empathy for Palestinians, and Palestinians deserve justice, and they deserve self-determination. And Israeli Jews, I have empathy for them.
Right.
If you're putting out the message that way, that gives you a certain amount of power to counter that message. And the fact that those of you who are coming from a Christian perspective are saying that is really significant. Secondly, in terms of using the power of words, you know, we're Americans and we can influence our elected officials. And I'm speaking specifically about Congress. I mean, yeah, it's, I get pretty cynical too, but specifically with Congress, you know, you get told again and again that if there's a certain amount of calls made, they really influence elected officials. And right now, there's a lot of movement going on to counter what the Trump administration is doing in terms of closing off opportunities for furthering the work of peace and justice.
Yeah.
And
I don't think he knows what that means.
For example, for our senators to get messages to support what Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, I think Jeff Merkley, and other senators are putting out in terms of supporting a two-state solution and the United States making a commitment to that is really important. It feels like deja vu all over again, that we're still having to do this. But these senators and Congress people need to hear our voices, and that in order to have the courage to support those initiatives. And in certain ways, sometimes it can feel like, is this really going to work? But it's one of the few options we have. And if the next election, as we say in Yiddish, Kane Hora, against the evil eye, etc., if the next election succeeds in changing an administration, that administration is going to have to have Congress pushing it to do the right thing.
But it is really interesting to see what's happening just like on an interest level with the evangelicals and Israel and Trump and the third temple being rebuilt. It's a whole thing that, I mean, I feel like I would understand much better if I was Christian, because it has, but what's funny about it is that
because we're, none of us are out of that tradition. I mean, most of us don't even understand.
Right. Well, so, but it's what's interesting is that one group wants to support, is willing to support Trump in order to support Israel in this way for theological purposes, meaning ignoring all this other horrible stuff about him and supporting because of Israel. And Israel is willing to accept the help of evangelicals because they're 100% sure that things aren't going to go down the way they think they are. And so they can, so in some ways it's like, it's a lot of nefarious forces of people who don't actually respect each other, are not actually on the same page. It's opportunistic power. And what we know from world history is they can do some damage, but they will combust from within, because I think when you're rooting for both people and you're saying, I love you and I love you, and I want you both to succeed and both to flower and for both of your children and grandchildren to thrive, that's a very different message. That's a very different type of support. And so I think that when progressive Christian Jews and Muslims all get together and come from a place of love and true shared values, as opposed to some kind of weird, corrupt, theological, thing. There's great power in that.
I call it weaponizing your faith. And so that people are using an excuse or a background of some sort of warped sense of your faith so that you're using it as a weapon against someone else.
Yeah.
Well,
you know that
you're not going to go to heaven because. Yeah. That kind of thing that I think makes it very, very difficult. Even if I let go of that with someone, it's very difficult to try to have a further conversation because they basically slammed the door shut.
One of the most depressing things when I was in the Holy Land was to hear that they do not teach Arabic in Israeli schools, and they do not teach Hebrew in the Palestinian schools.
Yes.
Because again, there's the divide.
Right. Even though a lot of the Jews came from lands where they speak Arabic as their first language.
They interact with each other all the time, and they for commerce and all that. When they get together, they work it out. But
yeah, well, actually, despite that, a lot of people end up speaking both languages.
Absolutely.
And I think that for you to practice your sound bites, the power that you have, if you call, we're Washingtonians. If you call Senator Patty Murray's office or Maria Cantwell's office, you say, I'm a Lutheran, and I believe in security for Israelis and Palestinians, and I'm asking you to sign on to such and such a resolution. That's having people's back. And you can figure out however you want to say it, but I think the important thing is to say, this is who I am, and I support my Palestinian and Jewish neighbors. And the security of both peoples
is important.
And I believe this is in America, in the interest of the United States. In the world.
That's a value as appropriate, as necessary for the world.
And it may sound like BS. Yeah. to a certain degree. But the question is, how can you get them to hear you? And how can, by being involved in that process, you broaden that kind of safety, of circle of safety that we were alluding to earlier? These are really important concrete actions that can be taken. And when people say they don't believe in peace, demonstrate that you know people, that you know a bit about the complexity of it and the nuance of it, and how we have to, you know, it's really important to work that way through it and understand that that if people feel safe, they can, there's a lot better chance they're going to move ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And don't let anybody tell you peace isn't possible.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, it's not that's some kind of existential problem that can never get cured.
But I really appreciate how you framed it. I'm so glad that you put it on the agenda. It gives me hope. I've just been really shut down. I feel like so isolated. I feel really, really isolated in my
domination. Oh, it is. It's called the line now, but...
And I was really glad I got to hear my kids.
Okay.
I think
all right.
I'm also for Palestinian rights, as you know.
Of course.
But, you know, I...
And her mother.
And people, if you use that word, like, in some sort of way, it's just like,
they're
Zionist. People, like, go ballistic.
They do. And, yeah.
But thank you. I mean, just, I was scared. I mean, I was like,
yes.
I mean, you know, like, it's going to make me all upset, and I'm going to go back to my room, and I'm going to be like, you know.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think, was it you I was talking about, well, the way a sense of betrayal works is very interesting, because I know people in the Jewish community who feel betrayed by Israel, and are really angry and bitter about it. And as a result, they really can't work well with other Jews to shift them. Because they just have that anger. And it's interesting. I find that in parts of... I mean, I'm a committed leftist, but I find in parts of the left community that people seem to feel betrayed by Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That we stepped out of line. Because by behaving badly, and so therefore, we betrayed those people, the critics, the people who are neither Jewish nor Palestinian.
Mm-hmm. So,
and it's kind of a fascinating thing.
It's really,
it's like we were kind of the model minority,
right?
And then
and such leaders and civil rights and the peace movement and so forth.
It was like 20 years
and
of world history,
and we had suffered and then we behave badly.
Right.
And so everything falls apart. And it's our fault. Well, of course, when people misbehave, it is their fault.
Yeah. But you're talking about within this country, Jews on the left.
I'm talking about the strange way that that bias works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although but the thing is, we all pretend like we don't benefit from nationalism when all of us do.
Right.
You know, I mean, we all benefit from nationalism.
But then also the way nationalism swings back and bites you.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Like, you know, in Israel, one thing that was really clear when I was there was the siege that the left is under in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And there are efforts again and again and again to pass laws to restrict freedom of expression for Jews.
Yeah.
As well as Palestinians. And, you know, you can't maintain an occupation without it having a corrosive influence.
Right.
You can't
Yeah, we're going to be looking at that soon here, too.
You can't have Trump behaving the way
Trump behaves
here
without enabling,
right.
Really, without,
exactly.
As we've seen, enabling
right.
Really dangerous.
The Niemöller quote, you know, first they came for them, then they came for it, now it's going to be pretty, I mean, you know, we're losing our liberties, you know, damn it. Yeah.
But luckily, Israel has a legal system, and we have a legal system, and it's true that they keep on bumping up against it. You know, Israel's legal system keeps, you know, it's like, they do take things through courts, and there's this bumping process, and the question is, are democracies, and this is the test of our democracy strong enough to keep moving forward, or will they
even
crumble
slowly.
Even slowly? Or democracy is not
going. And it's a global. I mean, this is
the global
issue.
Yeah.
Well, what gives me some hope is that, like Faith Action Network, I've been a part of that.
Tell me your name.
Steve Christensen.
Okay.
And it gives me good feeling that that organization has taught people to be themselves and take actions that they don't know that they can take. Mm-hmm. They write letters, they make calls, and they advocate for a certain amount of things every year. But things happen. Things get done.
They do. And we're, I mean...
And part of that, to me, is It broadens the faith in the citizenry that we can take actions
and
that our government will react in the way that we wish it to act.
And Israel-Palestine, we've gone through a few things lately, but we're trying to keep a broad tent.
Yeah.
First of all, we don't do foreign policy issues. So, I mean, but like the Faith Action Network, it's really important for us to, to have the involvement of the Jewish community, and including parts of it that are toward the center.
I know that there's a struggle going on.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I know.
Yes.
I hear some inside scoop.
Right. Well, and we are now... we've really committed to, keeping the broad tent, recognizing that there will be different points of view about Israel-Palestine, and we are trying to be mindful of, certainly as the core organization, but we have different people on our board, and I think it's okay, and we just, our co-chair, Rabbi Aaron Meyer, has just moved to Pittsburgh and could be a rabbi there. And we have Rabbi Ruth Zlotnick coming on the board, which is really good for us because it's like, It's good. I mean,
I'm sorry, I have to
go.
Thank you. Things creep in, and you have to struggle we're not all gonna agree on this. And I think that's one of the things that to me was hopeful about this, that people in the way you presented it. Starting with the trauma too. I think, That was really, really good. It could have gone a different kind of way.
Well, the challenge is also, to acknowledge that we're not going to agree on everything is really important.
Mm.
And we certainly need to, we have a skill deficit of how to deal with being able to argue productively.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen that a lot we saw that with the Women's March stuff, for example.
Yeah.
And that there seemed to be a real deficit of how do you work through things. So acknowledging that we're not going to agree on everything is important, but what about challenging one another to figure out what we do agree on? And people need to be pushed on that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't perfect, it's dangerous to say, oh, I believe in such and such and such, but, and then when a certain button gets pushed, begin to equivocate.
We're in a place that requires great skill of interaction, because it's the same thing that's happening with progressive community in the United States is, it's almost, I mean, most rabbis and most, liberal Jews are left of center around Israel. I think that we all want the same result, which is everybody living in safety and peace.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's a lot of, because, it's not like the Orthodox community is participating in FAM. So is just a certain segment of the Jewish community.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just requires such great patience and skill.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is...
Yeah, no,
is
and I am so... just about FAM, I'm really grateful for the co-directors that we have about this right now. They are, so many people on the left are so over here about BDS and everything like that, that I just, to have two Christian background co-directors that are just really sensitive about this issue, I find really, really.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
I'm just thankful because I don't want to just be the one holding that up on the board. And I think our board actually. I mean, we don't have really strong. I don't know. Maybe we do on our. We just don't get into this stuff. But but it has been kind of leaking in here and there, We had a good conversation with Anila. Just trying to hear some things from her, and because we'd really listened to Aaron and hadn't sort of gone around and listened to every rabbi, but trying to hear the different points of view, and how do you have a big tent so that we can do the work together that we need to do. I mean, that's the question. How do we do so well on these, by and large, on these solidarity actions? I mean, we just, just all step up and we're, get all the speakers and we do all that, I don't know. I mean, at least that means that we're talking to each other, and so that maybe at some point that can get into... back to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But I know it's really, from what I hear, it's really tough in synagogues that people don't really want to talk about it, right?
I think a lot of synagogues in town, they're pretty paralyzed about how to deal with it.
Yeah.
I've heard that from people at Beth Am that you just can't, not Beth Am.
Beth Shalom.
But no.
I would say definitely Beth Shalom has a tough time.
Beth Shalom is...
Even despite what we know about who's there.
Yeah, I think when you take the approach that everyone deserves love and everyone deserves the right to self-determination, it's a little easier to talk about it.
Yeah, because
so that's
there's a lot of ways you can say what people deserve.
Right, and well, yes, but just talk about it in terms of like our
all sorts of nice things we can say.
Right,
depending on who you're talking to.
What about them? Your congregation.
I mean, I say what I feel. I talk about Jerusalem and my vision of it being an international city of peace and our sacrifice. I talk about all that.
Yes.
And so they understand that. I mean, I think especially when we're praying together, we have to think beyond the current craziness to a vision of what's possible.
Quo,
yeah. Right. And just keep an eye on and then keep working towards it, but have a vision of what's possible. Because when you don't have a vision of what's possible, then you don't know what you're working for. And
I
so
you've been so out there on Facebook. I mean, when you posted your, I do read what you write, and when you posted that whole long one about last year sometime about being a Zionist, and I looked at all responses. I swear I was probably the only non-Jew that responded. I bet. I just guessed that, but I was really grateful to say. I mean, how you put yourself out there about that, because because you have, I mean, you have a lot of, I'm sure you have a lot of Facebook friends that are not Jewish, and and so it's really important for them to read that, as well as people in your congregation and that you're friends with. I mean,
I do have people in my congregation who don't have a relationship with Israel and don't understand the need to have a relationship with Israel. And I think that that's what a lot of American Jews are feeling. And for me, I feel like that's a place of privilege.
Yeah.
You know, that's a real, to think that you don't, you know, because that I don't have.
Because of your
Israeli,
history.
I can't, holding an Israeli passport and, you know, it's like, that's not a privilege that I have to think that Israel, that I could be fine without Israel. And it also makes me question their understanding of Jewish history and, you know, what, and because you can get very, very narrow, you know, in a perspective.
Right,
and so, but that does exist, and so we have to deal with it, and it's part of our civilization. I mean, there have always been people who are anti-Zionist within the Jewish world. It was, you know, because Israel wasn't supposed to be a place until the Messiah came. Yeah. So the whole idea of it was really radical in the first place, you know.
I mean, there's always these, I keep having seen images of Neteri Karta.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, right.
And people are saying, oh, look, good Jews.
Oh, right, right, exactly.
And,
right.
And I'm thinking, you wouldn't want to live next to those people.
Yeah. Right.
They're fundamentalists.
You know, they're fundamentalists. You know, like, you know, how they feel about women and so on. And
well, even within own family, my really good friends are Jonas and Charles Davis, and we see each other a lot. I think I'm more Zionist than Saint Jonas, you know. And Jonas, but see, it's interesting because she didn't grow up. I mean, it has to do a lot with your own personal story,
right? Right.
You know, she grew up in Rhode Island. She says, "Well, our family, we never, you know," she said, "we weren't Israel wasn't a thing for our family,
right.
You know." Where if that wasn't true for Charles, who grew up his parents were, he grew up in Washington State, but his parents were from Great Britain, and, you know, Zionism was important in their household and stuff. So in that family, you know, but, you know, I get some posts from Jonas and some posts from Charles, and, you know, it's so within a synagogue, within a family, there can be real,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You
know? I've known Charles and Jonas for a long time.
I know that.
I
just
need to get up that bridge. I'm sorry to excuse myself.
Yeah.
I just need to find something to drink. But thank you all.
Thank you.
So nice
Mona,
to thank you so much for this conversation and for
all the contributions that you made today. So,
my pleasure.
You know, it's just really complicated. I actually think that the emphasis on Israel has been one that wrote, was dealing with sort of a response to assimilation, too.
Mm.
Because it was filling a gap that was set up by the process of assimilation, by the kind of denaturing of Judaism in America in a certain era.
Okay. Yeah, so it was an answer to that. Then people,
well,
and
took, in some ways, it took the place of other things,
of
cultural and.
Well, and
cultural
does that relate to
that?
I mean, does that relate at all to that Reform synagogues going back to more Jewish practice compared to sort of more of the Protestantization of Reform Judaism? I mean, does that relate at all to that? I mean. What you're saying?
I think people needed to have a way to feel like they were expressing their connection to a Jewish identity.
Right, and
it's true that many Reformed congregations, for example, were assimilating into a more Protestant model and kind of losing a certain amount of oomph in a way.
I
don't want to be really sophisticated, but.
Well, that was happening in the 50s.
They
had Sunday schools and they did all that. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And at this point, I think things have shifted.
Yeah.
I think that Jewish identity in America has gone through a real revolution in many productive ways, and it's a very fertile thing. But still, you know, we have that legacy. I would be reluctant, if I were being really honest, to call myself a Zionist.
Yeah.
I think it's all moot.
Right.
We have a situation that's in front. I do believe in people's right to determine their destiny.
Yeah.
I don't believe in people's right to do that at the expense of taking from others.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And I only Yeah. And I only say...
And a lot of people often don't, you know, ask them, well, what's Zionism? They're not going to get very clear answers either.
Yeah. No, and if I'd say Zionist, nobody would have a clue what I mean by that, which is, you know, could read before the Middle East.
So
the Zionist idea, Arthur Hertzberg, and, you know, but basically what it means for me, and this is it means that at a fundamental level, I accept Israel's right to exist. And I do that, and that maybe is a real minimal definition of Zionism, but I believe it has a right to exist, not based on biblical, or not based on even a moral claim. I see it more as that, the international community did.
It's there.
It's there.
We have an Israeli identity. We have people. That's their only home.
Right. And the UN, you know, approved the existence of Israel after. So that's the basis on which...
A practical thing.
Right. Well, it's not only that it just exists. That's part of it. But that it was established by the international community. And that I say that also having lived, I lived in, Jordan from 82 to 85, when people were still, Arabs. I mean, we'd go to Syria and stuff, they were still talking about, still talking about Israel not existing.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, and I hear that now in places on the left. I mean, really, I hear that same sort of, reminds me of George Jabour in Syria, and the Zionism is racism, the UN resolution, and all the, so partly why I would say, use that word Zionism, is in the context of that, is in the context of there are people that don't think Israel has a right to, historically, and there are people now, and I'm not one of those people, even as horrible as Israeli policy is, and I don't think they have, the right to have...
It's pretty horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, what I saw was...
Oh, it's just...
I mean, actually, the worst that I saw was in East Jerusalem, where I witnessed what I will call ethnically based, politically imposed gentrification.
Yeah.
Where... and displacement, where people were being evicted from their homes based on specious claims from before 1948 about property ownership, where those people had no right to work to reclaim their homes that their families had fled in West Jerusalem, and that this was all expedited by the state, essentially, and what that represented. It was terrible. But then I was side by side with Israeli Jews who were opposed to that and were working in solidarity with the neighborhood Palestinian neighborhood committees and so on. So myself.
But do Jews here? I mean, this, one of the things is, why aren't more Jews here doing what you're doing? I mean, that's the that's.
I think that it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I think people are being the embrace of Bibi and Trump. Really is disturbing a lot of people.
Yeah, okay.
And
and
the partnership with the evangelicals.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really distressing to a lot of people. It's causing profound discomfort.
Yeah.
And that is setting up some dissonance that maybe it worked. In terms of how you deal with, like, for example, the Jewish Federation, the ADL.
And that's part of.
I don't have any clear answers. I know how Anila feels about the ADL.
Yeah.
And she's got a point.